Our podcast today is produced at St. John's Lutheran Church in Salisbury, North Carolina, where we see the church as an important venue for conversations that matter, a place where we can and should engage in good, faithful, sometimes hard conversations about issues and events that need our attention. For more conversations like these, visit our website, stjohns-salisbury.org, or follow this podcast on your preferred platform.
Women's Justice is reaching into the church. At Assisi Heights, there's a conference celebrating the 10th anniversary of the ordination of the first female pastor. And we have that pastor with us, who is also the chaplain at the University of Maryland. Welcome to our program, Pastor Beth Platts.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rhodes Woolley, and I'm pleased to have with me two of my favorite pastors, Laura Henrich and Danielle Denise, here to discuss the 50th anniversary of ordaining women in the Lutheran Church. Both have served as pastors at St. John's and bring with them a great passion for pastoral ministry. Danielle is currently the director of evangelical ministry through the North Carolina Synod, and Laura is our pastor for youth and discipleship here at St. John's. They're bright, they're innovative, they're fun to be around, and they're strong gifts to the church. So, Danielle and Laura, welcome.
Thank you.
50 years ago, this November, Elizabeth Platts was ordained as the first female pastor in an American Lutheran church. It was a monumental moment, as you know, certainly affected your lives and your history. Although she certainly was not the first woman in the church's history to serve in a leadership role. The Bible lifts up Phoebe in the book of Romans, Paul's partner Prisca, what the book of Acts calls Philip's prophetic daughters. In early church writings, it's clear that gatherings of Holy Communion were held in the homes of prominent women who served at the table in a sacramental role. The church was pushing against a cultural norm in Rome, which subjugated women and slaves, only to cave in 500 years later when the Pope forbid women to serve in that capacity. But for the first 500 years, they served in that capacity. Just recently, Pope Francis declared that he believes the church's ban against female priests is forever. Danielle, let me start with you. You were baptized in the Serbian Orthodox Church, which does not ordain women. In fact, 70% of the world's Christians are in churches that still refuse to ordain women. So if you had a chance to stand in front of Pope Francis and the leaders of these churches, what would you say to them? Why ordain women?
So I think I would say two things. The first one, maybe in not my best humanity, would say, why not? Right? Why not use the gifts of all of God's children in proclaiming the gospel from a called out, set a place part? But the other thing I would probably do is actually tell the story of the last two times I've been back to the Serbian Orthodox Church. When my grandmother died, when I first started working here at St. John's, at her funeral, the priest came and said, I need someone to read the epistle. And my whole family looked at me and said, well, it should be Danielle. Like, she does this for her life. And the priest said, I'm sorry, it can't be her. And my brother, they said, where's the oldest male grandchild? And my brother was like, well, I am, but Danielle should read this. And the priest just said no. And instead of that funeral being a place where our family felt like all this closeness, they were sort of like mad at the church in the middle of it. Like, why can you not do this? I was recently back just a few months ago for my cousin's funeral, and the priest, same thing happened. They were like, I need someone to read the epistle. And this, a new priest, looked at me and they said, Danielle should do it. And he said, okay, you're welcome here. And he let me read as part of the funeral service. And what I would say is, when you allow women in public places, you create space for a different voice, quite literally a different voice in the tenor and the tone, but also in a different way in which we grieve and feel and see and think about the scriptures. And I just always think, like, why would we not want all the voices proclaiming? We should want all of God's children proclaiming, whether they're in public ministry or not, but why not invite us into that space? And I will say, I feel very changed having read in the Serbian Orthodox Church and looking at my family at a moment in time. But I also know how many of them said to me, it was so beautiful to hear your voice. in this moment in our life. Not only because I'm their family, but also because very few of them ever hear a female voice in the church. And so I think that is a gift. The other thing that I would say, and I think this is true beyond a gendered body, but also in regards to race and age and different things, is our church becomes a more visible sign of the kingdom of God when all of us are represented. When we have leaders of color, when we have leaders who are young, step forward, people of color say, I can belong in this place. There was a study about 2 years ago that came out that said girls who have pastors who are women as their pastors actually rate stronger in self-confidence. And I think part of it is because they see women leading, holding public conversations, making decisions, doing all of those things. And I just feel like the gender of my body does not disqualify me from being someone who publicly proclaims and holds public ministry as a vocation.
It doesn't disqualify you, but it does make you distinct.
Oh, yeah.
What distinct aspects of being female do you bring as a female to the art of pastoral ministry?
So I don't want to overdo stereotypes, because I think that's one thing that doesn't actually help pastors who are women. I think people tend to experience pastors as women who are quite compassionate, who have space for grieving. But I really think about it more in the areas of something like infertility and miscarriage, or things, breast cancer and reconfiguration surgeries and things like that, that feel so personal to women as they go through them, that it's not that they won't share it with a male pastor, but to have that space with someone who may understand that, I think is really, really huge. I was talking to a woman who grew up in the Catholic Church, and she had had two miscarriages, and she said, I never told my priest. It didn't occur to me that if I had had a woman in leadership, that maybe I could have gone to the church and shared my grief. So it's not a universal blanket answer. This is what we bring. And quite frankly, it's not true for all women. I have my previous congregation, I had a family come and say, to visit the church and tell me to my face on the way out, that was a good service, but we will not be back because you are female and you are the pastor here. And, you know, it does not mean I bring things for all people, but I do think that having a woman in leadership opens up space in some unique and different ways. But I think especially around things like, I don't know as many male pastors that are thinking, how can we have a survey or a service of remembrance on the day, the National Day of Mourning around miscarriages? That's something we got to talk about and we've got to wonder about. Or how many of us include names of babies who have died in All Saints celebrations? One of my best friends, that is what she brings to her church. And she said the first All Saints Sunday that she read her baby's name that she lost, 20 women had come up to her and said, can I tell you the name of the baby that I lost?
Pastor Laura, likewise, if you had the chance to stand in front of a group of leaders in the world's church who previously had said no to ordaining women, what case would you make? Why ordain women?
I think that it's the ability to, as Danielle was touching on, but it's the ability to see life through a different lens. And when we're able to honor both sexes at a table in leadership positions and their voices at a table, I think that it brings a deeper sense of unity and of the church to that time and space.
So what important contributions do you think, or attributes, characteristics, whatever, however you want to define it, do you think women pastors bring to the church today?
The only congregations I've served in are in team positions. And you and I talk about this often, that there's something to be said when you can have both of those lenses at the table, because some people are going to feel more comfortable approaching a male pastor. Some people are going to feel more comfortable approaching a female pastor. And both of those situations are okay. And so I think that if we know the different gifts we bring, then we can look at where other strengths need to come in as well. And again, I think that it just provides better care to the church as a whole.
Let me ask a little bit about your story, Laura, because I know that you've had some very strong women in your past, even in ordained ministry, who have served as solid examples for you. Why did that matter in your journey?
So, as a middle schooler, I remember sitting down planning a youth Sunday service, and I heard the hymn. I think we were talking through hymns, and our organist was there. She was playing through different hymns, and the hymn, "Here I Am, Lord," came on, and I remember looking at Amy Figg, who at that point was not a pastor. She was our youth minister. I actually got to walk with her through the ordination process, which was a huge impact on my journey. But I remember looking at her saying, wow, she has blonde hair like me. She looks like me. I could do this too. And it was, and I remember, I think that that's probably the first time that I felt called to ministry. Yet my life got off track, and it wasn't until I was in college that that kind of resurgence came back. But having somebody that looks like you in a leadership position, whether it was the youth minister or watching her go through that ordination process, it helped me know that I could be that too. And it just opened up a different possibility for my life. And so to see somebody in a strong leadership position that looked like me, that had long hair like me, that had this, you know, all those different things, that was okay with wearing lipstick and makeup, all of those things helped shape and form, I can do this too. And again, I think, just as Danielle said, when you have women in leadership standing up in front, you're impacting the young girls in the congregation completely differently.
Good. Pastor Danielle, what about you? Is there a moment in your journey or moments that sort of come to mind that helped you to think, yeah, that's what I want to do?
I didn't have any women along the way that were in formal ministry settings. I did not have, I grew up in a larger church. We had multiple male pastors. I did have like Sunday school teachers, and Mrs. Graham, who was my, like, I just love her, you know. So I had, this is back to Laura's point about it provides an opportunity for the church, if you don't have a female leader on staff, to raise up women that are models and examples in the faith that affect you. But I would say, because I did not have what Laura had, it took me about 10 years to decide to be ordained. I mean, I've spent a lot of time saying, I've never seen a church have space for me. And even when I started, I was a deacon, because all I saw was female deacons who had my same kind of heart and no church that had space for them in a pastoral setting. So my experience was really different of having, I don't think I heard a woman preach until I went to seminary. And I did not hear a woman of color preach until probably 5 years ago. I mean, that's pretty heartbreaking for me. And I think about, especially like young girls of color thinking, do I belong? Is there space for me if they never hear that voice? So that has not been true for me. As far as ordination, I was consecrated as a diaconal minister before, which is just a fancy word for deacon. And I actually chose to be ordained, it sounds kind of strange, but during the funeral, I'm talking a lot about funerals. I'm usually not a Debbie Downer, but I'm talking a lot about funerals. Eric Lentz died, and Pastor Rhodes was in Guatemala, and I did a funeral. And in the middle of his funeral, I looked at his daughter, which is interesting when you talk about women. I looked at his daughter, and she was singing an anthem that they sang at her wedding, and that was being sung at her dad's funeral. And I felt like the Spirit said, you see that? You see her singing along? You are called to be in these holy moments. and I want you to move towards ordination. And that was it for me. And I think the next week I called the bishop's office and said, I want to be ordained. I want to be in the moments of water and wine and bread and in these holy spaces. But much of my ministry was carved out with strong, strong women in lay positions. But really, I wonder sometimes if I had had a pastor who was a woman, if I would have seen myself as ordained far before a decade of, I mean, really, I was ordained in 2015. I started thinking very seriously about ministry in 2003.
So. I know you're not saying this. I guess I just want to leave space, though, for some of the finest women leaders in the church, in the church's history, have not been ordained.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
A leader in the church does not require one to be ordained. Even today, certainly in the time, the long period of time when we refused to ordain women, but even now, with some outstanding, very qualified, bright women who have stepped up as leaders, but have no calling into ordained ministry.
Absolutely. And honestly, I think if I were to look back on my journey, the women who I would say nurtured my ordination call were not ordained women, was what I was trying to say, is that they were Lucille Graham. You know, they were women who said, I see something. There were a woman named Hazel Slocum who said, someday you're going to be ordained. I hope you call me and tell me that. And I did. And she was like, I told you 10 years ago this was going to happen. So, of course, there are so many women. But there are also so many men in that role. So why not also then afford us the opportunity to be in public ministry in an ordained role?
Mm-hmm. Pastor Laura, what's your greatest joy in being an ordained pastor?
Relationships. I think that to walk alongside people in moments of great happiness, that they're celebrating things like weddings and graduations and all of those fun moments in life, but then also to be let in on some of the most holy and sacred space of brokenness and hurt and what that looks like. I think that that's where I find the greatest joy, is in the midst of those relationships.
What about the biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge, and this is probably more the phase of life I'm in, but balancing how to be and feel like a good mom, a good wife, and a good pastor all at once.
Pastor Danielle, what about you? What's your greatest joy in ordained ministry?
I think right now I'm in a pretty unique call. I serve the churchwide expression, but I'm here in North Carolina, and one of my particular call responsibilities is the starting of new congregations. And one of my great joys is to see people fall in love with Jesus. Right? Like, and that happens in the parish too. I'm not saying that it doesn't in traditional established parishes, but to see people who have traditionally been outside the kind of confines of the church to find love and grace and to just learn the story, not only of the churches that I expect or grew up in, that look like churches I grew up in or have worked in and served in, but to get to see to have worship in Cherokee and have worship in Spanish and just get to feel the fullness of God in really kind of unique ways in this call has been a great joy to me. I think, I mean, I could have said relationship, because I think that's a huge part of it. I think that's the gift of being pastor, is that you are pastor with people, not just on an island by yourself, right? And if you're on an island by yourself, you're not probably being a pastor very well. but the recent joy for me has been the broadness of the gospel and hearing it proclaimed in so many different ways.
Sociologists tell us that major cultural shifts take about 100 years to be realized. If that cultural shift began in the 60s and early 70s, when will this shift regarding women in ministry in ordained ministry, let's say, being fully accepted in their role. When will that be sort of the norm?
Sadly, I probably won't be alive, which will make me sad, but I hope I lead in a way that Olive will experience it. I don't know when that'll be the norm. I do think that women have got to be in places of leadership for that to be part of the norming process. And I don't just mean as associate pastors or as solo pastors. I mean as senior pastors of some of our larger congregations, which we have almost no women leading our larger congregations in the North Carolina Synod. I think it is as bishops as well. We've had the largest amount of women bishops in the ELCA in particular, and have a woman presiding bishop who was reelected. And I think those are part of a norming process. Do I think that means that men have absolutely no role in leadership? No, I do not. It doesn't help to swing the pendulum the other way, right? To say like we've had all men, so now we need to have all women. But we've got to find a place where we can be at the table together in some kind of way with equity around hearing our voices so that we can normalize this. And I would say the other part of how I think some of the norming will come, and this goes back to the challenge question, is the courage and bravery of women leaders to continue to persist when it can be really, really hard. The presiding bishop just brought on a staff member beginning May 1st to look at the quality of calls for women, because we are having really high rates of women leaving ministry, I think partially because of the reality of balancing family and this and social expectations around what that looks like. I think partially because ministry is just really hard right now. But I wonder, women are just going to have to be brave and walk into spaces. I was having a conversation with a woman who was a senior pastor in Baltimore, and she said, I had to decide early on that part of my call was to be a pioneer, and I had to be okay pioneering, because that meant I was going to have some really hard chimes and challenges and conversations. And she looked at me and she said, but I pioneered because I want you to have the space to do this in a way that I didn't have to. And I'm thankful for that. And I really hope that I can be the kind of pastor that can look at the next generation or the generation after that and say, I hope that I'm leading in a way that you're going to have your own bumps and bruises, because ministry does, but I hope you don't have to have all the same ones that I do. And I imagine someone like Elizabeth Platts, who started all of this, has really different bumps and bruises than we do, but they still exist.
You know, I find it interesting because my first two calls were in Minnesota and North Dakota, and there are more Lutherans there than there are people. And there was a lot of women in leadership roles. And so being raised in the South and seminary in the South and internship in the South, when I went up there, one of the things that I was most surprised at is that I could be at a table and I didn't have to justify why I was at the table. My internship congregation, my supervisor wouldn't even allow me to go to the clergy breakfast that they had, because he's like, it's just the good old boys, and really you just don't want to be a part of that. And so I created my own space to have clergy interaction. But when I was up there, there are so many more women in leadership roles that it was more normalized at that point. And therefore, it meant that I just got to walk into that. And coming back down to the South, I find that right when I sit at an ecumenical table, I have to justify more why I'm there or who I am or, you know, whatever that is. And
Pastor Laura, you've been doing some study of 1 Peter lately. 1 Peter, the author, Peter, whoever it is, tells us in the midst of suffering or persecution or whatever it is that the church was going through at the time, these early Christians, to suffer for the sake of good rather than suffering for the sake of evil. So if it is the sake of, sort of living in a place of, whether I don't want to suggest that you're calling it suffering, but whatever you define it as, tell me about the good for the sake of good.
I think that we, like Danielle was saying, that we do this for the next generation. I hope that 10 years from now, a female pastor that comes along, that's a mother, the demands that that has on her as a woman, plus being a mom, I would hope that we would better understand that we would have some more tools in our bag to say, hey, listen, this is how we can navigate through that. But I hope that for male colleagues as well, that I just see that there's such a burnout rate at all. And that we can raise that up. So I think that anything that we're, quote, suffering for, one of the other things it says in that passage in 1 Peter is that we always are able to carry a sign of hope, that we're always able to defend it with a sign of hope. And that would be mine, that whoever's coming after me, just like I stand on the shoulders of the giants that came before me, that they also are standing on something that has been shifted at that time.
So where do you see the light in this conversation now, today? Yeah. And where do you see the living stones today? And where do you see that living hope today?
I see it in a movement of, there's more women that are still going into ministry. There's a 50-50 voice at the table. And I do see that as crucially important for our church, that we still raise up those leaders and that they're still coming, you know, to the table as well. And that's, I think, that where I see the hope is that just today I got to see one of my youth from back in Knoxville who is graduating from seminary, and she got a preaching award at the seminary that she's at. And yeah, right? This is why there's still women coming to the table. And that's where I find hope, is that we're just consistently coming. Can't stop us.
No, that is good. I mean, that's lovely, because unfortunately it does take time, doesn't it? Right. And so when you have those watermarks and you can see, there's another. Yep, there's another, and she brings amazing gifts to this task.
And also, when I'm in conversation with in my previous congregation, there was an amazing young woman who was considering going into ministry, and you start to have those conversations, that there are authentic and real parts of that. That I tell her, this is hard, but ministry is hard. But it's worth it at the end of the day. And that's a hard thing to explain to people when they see certain aspects of it. And yeah, it's hard, but it is so worth it. And you can't explain that joy when you are doing something that God has called you to do and you're actually living that out. The marrying of those two just brings joy. And I think that if you're doing something else that you're not called to, I don't think you're going to have that. And I said, one of the first things I said to her was, is there anything else that you could do that you could see yourself being happy with? And I said, if you say yes, then you should probably do that, because this call is hard. So you have to know and not say, gosh, I wish I would have been. Right? This is what you want to do. This is where you want to be. This is where God is calling you to be. Because there is so much joy, even in the midst of suffering.
Yeah, and that's a vocational question in general, right? I mean, any job is hard if it doesn't feel like a call.
Right?
That is certainly true in ministry. Mm-hmm. We are blessed to be in a vocation that we feel called to. but we also know that there are plenty of folks with whom we serve who are called into their particular vocations. And theirs are difficult too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, I'd love to hear from you all this one last question. Let's go back to Elizabeth Platts. If you were able to say one thing to her, if she was here with us right now and you were able to say one thing to her, what would it be?
How do you want me to lead now so that 50 years from now, I can serve as a mentor to someone else? What do you know about being the first that I should know so that other generations are affected by my witness in ordained ministry?
Yeah, I think that, of course, I would express gratitude for that moment. Well done, good and faithful servant is another like phrase, right? Because I'm just like, yes. But I also think that I would say something that like the road was not easy, but because of your fierce boldness in just doing, that now the road is more worn and that we're going to continue to wear the road down, right, until it's the norm. So thanks for starting that.
Well, thank you all for your leadership and ministry, for your eagerness to pursue your call, for the unique gifts you bring to the church, to this church and so many other congregations, and certainly for your willingness to share deeply today. It's always a blessing to be in ministry with you and in partnership with you. I am privileged in that regard. So thank you for being here today. And thank you for joining us for another episode of Conversations That Matter, where we engage in conversation with thoughtful, passionate leaders who are making a difference in our community and in our lives. Until next time.